Blog Talk.
Fellow conservatives, this is Weekly Conservative Talk, and I'm just plain Bill, and apparently I've got the show all by myself again tonight. So, let's get started. Actually, I don't know that I've got an hour's worth of material here. Right now, there's just a whole lot of random thoughts running around in my head, so let's start out with maybe the first one. Everybody's heard about the Park 51, otherwise known as the Mosque at Ground Zero, right? Everybody's heard about that one. Everybody's heard about how that's supposed to be this great bringing together and cultural understanding between Islam and Christianity and Judaism and all the other things. It really seems to me that the people that perhaps did not directly cause the destruction of the Twin Towers, but who are acting in the name of the faith that caused the destruction of the Twin Towers, and that is Islam, and no, I am not politically correct. All of those hijackers were Islamists, every one of them. So to try to tell me that they were not complicit, that they were not involved, that they were not the precipitating cause of 3,000, almost 3,000 deaths at Ground Zero, is to boggle the imagination. And so they propose to build a cultural center, a 13-floor cultural center. The top of that cultural center is to be a mosque. Now, I don't know how hard you have to rub, but it certainly seems to me like that's rubbing salt into wounds. Now, what brings this up is Greg Gutfeld on Red Eye has a Twitter name, has been carrying on a conversation with Park 51. That, by the way, is the Twitter name of the people who are looking to build this. So if you all are on Twitter, you might tune into that, see what's being said. Anyway, Greg says, gosh, in the interests of cultural understanding, why don't I build a bar? Now, not just any bar, not just a bar that serves drinks and does all that kind of stuff. Why don't I build a bar that caters specifically to Islamic gay men? Ooh. Now, there's some cultural understanding for you. You will recall that Islam says, oh, gays have to be stoned, executed, hanged, their heads chopped off. Incidentally, they do that with women. Oh, yeah. Honor killings. Stoning. If you're a woman and you're raped, you have to have 4 male Muslims that attest to the fact that you were raped. Good luck on that one, by the way, ladies. So he proposes to build this bridged cultural understanding and cater to gay Islamic men. It's interesting that the reaction from Park 51 is that they would prefer that he not do that in the interest of understanding their culture. Now, it seems to me that they have poo-pooed that idea as far as the building of their mosque, but they are not willing to do that when it comes to something that offends their beliefs. So what? They're homophobes? I mean, what is it with this? They want cultural understanding, but they do not want to extend it? No, I'm sorry, that doesn't work. Not here in this country, or at least it didn't before this. And by the way, something that you may not have known, and that I don't know that I discovered, but at least found out about it recently, they need a couple of lots to build this thing. They've got one. Turns out the other one that they need is owned by Con Edison, the power company that serves New York. So I would suggest that y'all start contacting Con Edison and say, hey, we don't think it's a really great idea if you sell that lot to them. Don't think that that would be a really good idea, and see what they say. See if perhaps there are some negotiations going on. Just a word to the wise there. Okay, so there's your mosque, there's your cultural understanding. I don't think that really demonstrates a lot of cultural understanding to me. I am particularly struck by the hypocrisy of Park 51's response. They don't think that bridges any cultural misunderstandings between them and the gay world. Could just be me. I could be wrong, but, you know, it just really doesn't seem like it. So, there you go with the mosque. So, let's go on to some economic stuff. This has been bugging me. We have had a slow second quarter. Not a good one at all. And in fact, it may have gotten even slower than we knew. Now, as far as I know, the official number is, GDP grew at 2.7%. Well, you know, that may be true. I don't know. Except that retail sales fell. Employment fell. Admittedly, that was from government, and I am never disappointed when government employment falls, but unfortunately those were temporary positions associated with the census, and therefore probably shouldn't have been counted anyway. But nevertheless, they were there. And that's fallen. Private industry, theoretically, added 73,000 jobs. We had a net loss of 135,000 jobs. And I see where a major bank's economic forecast, actually not forecast, look back, said, you know what? We only grew at 1.2% GDP in the second quarter. That's a far cry from 2.7. I mean, that's less than half, folks. So what's going on there? I think the government's cooking the books. I mean, that's my own personal opinion. You can ascribe to that or not. I don't care. The point is this. We have falling employment. We have falling retail sales. And by the way, our economy is based about 70% on retail sales. We have a major bank that says 1.2% GDP. And you look at that, and you look at the amount of money that the government has spent. We're going to have, the government says, we're going to have a $1.2 trillion, that's trillion with a T, deficit this year. That is on top of a 1.67 trillion deficit in the preceding fiscal year. How many times do you think we can go to China, that we can go to any place and sell those bonds? How long do you think we can keep that up? We have set up, I spoke, I think 2 weeks ago, about perverse incentives and virtuous incentives. And I said, perverse incentives are those incentives that do not accomplish their stated goals. Greg W. Howard was on with me last week, and he said he really liked to refer to those as unintended consequences. I think perverse incentives have unintended consequences, but I don't think that they are what gives a perverse incentive its name. I think the perverse incentive comes first, then the unintended consequence happens. So, I talked a little bit about a virtuous incentive, and that is an incentive that actually does what it says it's going to do. Our economy right now is filled to the brim with perverse incentives. I mean, stop and think about this for a second. If you have 99 weeks, that's almost 2 years, of unemployment benefits, and by the way, those can range up to, depending on the state you're in, $600 a week. That's $2,400 a month. Is that taxable? Yeah, it is. But you know what? $2,400 a month is like $48,000 a year. That ain't shabby, folks. That isn't designed to get somebody back to work. That isn't even designed to tide them over until they find work. That's a way of life. That's simply a way to say, yep, we're going to redistribute your wealth. We're going to give it to these people who are out of jobs through apparently no fault of their own. And you can feel good about that because it's temporary. Folks, almost 2 years is not temporary. 6 months is temporary, not 2 years. 2 years is a way of life. So we have a perverse incentive that says, I'm going to reward these people for not working. And by the way, you aren't supposed to notice that they turn down jobs. I mean, how many jobs are out there at $48,000 a year? I can tell you there are none here in my town. There may be some in other towns. There may be some in cities, but they aren't here in my town. I know people that would, well, perhaps they wouldn't kill, but they do an awful lot for a $48,000 a year job. So right there we have a perverse incentive. What would be the virtuous incentive? Well, one of those might be structured along the lines of saying, okay, you're unemployed, no fault of your own. We're sorry about that. And what we're going to do is we're going to start you out at $600 a week. And by the way, that's going to decrease for every month that you're on unemployment. And maybe that will provide you an incentive to look a little harder for work. And maybe that will provide you a little incentive to perhaps take a job that is not necessarily in your career field, that you don't necessarily have the college training for, because college training isn't required for that job, but you will have a job. That could be an answer. Another way to do that would be to put a strict 6-month limit on it and say, look, you got to go out and find work. Now, if that's flipping hamburgers, then that's flipping hamburgers. But it's something. And it's more than a handout. I do not mind giving a hand up. I've done it in my life. Had it done for me in my life. That doesn't bother me. What bothers me is not a hand up, but a handout. Someone who simply will say, okay, I'm going to sit back and you all owe me. No, I don't really owe you. I'm sorry. That isn't something that really computes for me. I owe my family. I owe my siblings. I owe my parents. They're both dead, but nevertheless, I owed them when they were alive. I owe my children. Beyond that, no, I don't owe you. I may give to you as a charitable thing, but I don't owe you. So if that's true, then we have to say, what was the point of the unemployment extensions? Another economic thing for you. The current state bailout bill that just passed, what was it, $26 billion, something like that. Turns out that goes mostly to unions. Now, my dad was a union guy. He belonged to whatever union it was that the grocers belonged to, a lifelong grocery guy. And he belonged to that union. And I remember a couple of times when they went out on strike. And they were basically striking for better wages. But you know what? If you took what they got and said, okay, was it worth going out on that strike? And you look at the facts of the matter, how long they were out on strike, income that they forego. Turns out, no, that probably wasn't the best way to handle it. Turns out that's at best a break-even, and in some cases was a net loss over time. Unions are about now, not back in the 20s or the 30s, but now are about power. Not about getting something for the little guy. Not about making sure that people are safe on their jobs. We've got OSHA to do that. We don't need unions. It's all about power. Richard Trumka, union boss, said today, or yesterday, the deficit was a myth of the right-wing news. Those are his words. Myth. There's no deficit problem. None at all. And I sit there and listen to that and say, how far out of reality are you? You expect our kids, our grandkids, and we can get to the point where it's our great-grandkids, are going to have to pay this back without a concomitant increase in their ability to do so. There's been some talk about a balanced budget amendment. Folks, balancing the budget is easy. It's a piece of cake. How much are you spending? Raise the taxes to cover that. Doesn't take a genius to do that. Oh, you don't like more taxes? Too bad. So sorry. Here's all the programs we've got. We got to spend that money. We'll just raise the taxes. what in the world happened to small government? I mean, yes, I am older than most of you. I freely admit that. But I can tell you that I knew a time when a balanced budget was a most desired thing. Not a thing to say, well, that would be nice. Not a thing to say, well, of course we should, but on the other hand, we have all these needs. A balanced budget in and of itself was a good thing. And people tried to do that. Both parties. I mean, this isn't a one-party problem here, folks. And that brings me to elitism. So, what happens when you have a group of people, 535 of them, who for the very most part say, well, we really want to be reelected, and the way to do that is through pork and is through increased programs. And they have an ability to actually do that. They don't have any restraint on themselves. They don't have any limits on themselves. And so they say, well, sure, we can do that. And what do? That's what they do. They are not there to represent you and me, as we have seen with health care, as we have seen with TARP, as we have seen with the stimulus, as we have seen with Stimulus 2, as we have seen with all of these programs. What we have seen is a group of people that say, I want to be reelected. I want to serve another term. 2 years in the case of House of Representatives, 6 years in the case of Senators. And they have absolutely no compunction about lying to you to do that. Now, first off, it's never a good thing when a politician can lie to you with impunity. And yet, our courts have said, well, of course they can. That's mere puffery. A bagatelle, if you will. Not something to take serious. And yet these are the people who are deciding literally life and death for people. Now, you can laugh at Sarah Palin if you want. But you know what, folks? Death panels are there. Not called death panels. Not going to call them death panels. Comparative effectiveness. And we've got one of those. We have Medicare that's getting slashed to the tune of $500 billion, that's with a B, dollars. And Congress says, oh yeah, we're going to fix that real soon. But they haven't done it yet. And the reason that they didn't do it, and the reason that they had to cut it, was because if they didn't, their score on the health care bill was going to be out of sight. And so they had to do that. Dishonest? Absolutely. But remember, they can lie to you. It's okay. Courts have said it's okay. They can flat out lie to you. So how do you tell when a politician is telling you the truth? I mean, that's maybe a rhetorical question, but it's one I'm wrestling with, I'll tell you. As I look at politicians from my state of California, Meg Whitman, Carly Fiorino, to the deal handle thing in Georgia, to the Colorado thing with Buck and Norton, how do you believe them? I mean, they'll tell you one thing on the stump, talking to you trying to convince you about their conservative cred when you know that they can lie to you with impunity, with absolutely no consequences whatsoever. And so you ask yourself the question, well, how do I know you're telling me the truth? Here's the answer to that question. You don't. Arkansas Traveler just reminded me that states have a requirement to balance their budget, and that's true. State of California has that. We're only $20 billion in the hole. Arkansas has that. Every state in the union has to balance their budget. How do they do that? Well, mostly with smoke and mirrors. They defer some outgo here. They borrow. They do tax anticipation notes. They do a whole lot of tricks that doesn't really balance their budget. And you have to ask yourself, how come their budgets aren't balanced? I mean, what is it about a state that says, well, we have to do this? Kind of brings me back to my favorite subject, unions. Did you know that at least on the federal level, their compensation is about double that of the private sector? Now, private sector provides jobs. I mean, that's what they're in business for. That's what they do. Yeah, they sell products. They sell services. But in the course of that, they provide employment. Federal government doesn't. They provide direct employment via the federal government, but there is nothing that the federal government does that provides a job. They provide direct employment for the bureaucrats that write the rules and regulations. They provide for the bureaucrats that enforce those rules and regulations, but they don't provide jobs in the sense that they have a measurable output. And in fact, most of what they do is detrimental to the creation of jobs. I saw an amazing number, and this was apparently from a guy who has a small corporation. And his ability to provide jobs is severely impacted because he says this: Sally makes, and I forget the exact number, but it seemed to me like it was about $40,000 a year, $37,000, $40,000, something like that. And it costs $74,000 to provide her that job. Now, where do you think that difference comes from? Comes right out of his pocket. So how many times do you think he can afford to spend $74,000 to hire a $40,000 worker? And how many more jobs could he provide if he only had to spend the $37,000 or $40,000 that it took to actually hire them? And the answer is more than we've got now. Quite a few more than we have now. And each of those people are going to pay taxes on that. Now, do federal workers pay taxes? Well, some of them. Not all. Timmy Geithner didn't. Apparently, Rangel doesn't. But you know what? Most of the people in the private sector do. So, you have to ask yourself, so what kind of a system do we have here? And the answer is we don't have a system, or at least not one that's recognizable to us. We have a way to increase direct federal government employment But that's offset by the direct employment that private employers provide, which means that there is less goods and services being made. And by the way, did you know productivity went down 1.2% last quarter? Yeah, 1.2%. That's not a big number. Except that when you spread it out over all of the private employment numbers, that's a huge dollar amount. It also means that their employers either have to do one of two things. They have to hire more people. Wait, can't do that. There isn't any more demand out there. Or they have to cut back what they got. I suppose the third option would be try to muddle through as best they can and hope that the federal government doesn't do something more to them. I would submit that that last option probably is not a good option, because I think that the federal government has much more in mind for us than simply letting the status quo be. Gulf oil spill. Haven't heard a lot about that in the news except for this. Gosh, it appears that 75% of the oil has disappeared. And I read that and I said to myself, no, I don't think it just disappears. It may settle to the bottom. It may migrate. Some of it's going to get eaten by naturally occurring bacteria that does that kind of thing. But I don't think 75% of that oil is simply gone. Where is it? I don't know. Got no clue. I just don't know. Turns out the experts don't know either. But the point remains that some sizable fraction of that is still hanging around someplace. And the question in my mind is this. What's it doing? I mean, is it laying there benignly doing nothing? Is it interfering with some kind of, I don't know, reproductive cycle of oysters or lobsters or whatever the heck it is? I mean, what is it doing? We don't know. The scientists don't know. But everything is fine, folks. Nothing to see here. Move right along, please. Don't ask questions. Well, I want you to ask questions. I want you to talk to your congressperson and say, hey, I want a straight answer. Where'd that oil go? What's it doing? What kind of damage is it doing? Don't think you're going to get a straight answer. Not in their best interest to provide you one. But you ought to at least ask the question. Right? Okay. So, I got off the track of virtuous incentives. Shouldn't have done that, but I did. So, oh well, here we go. Virtuous incentives are those incentives that whose outcomes are congruent with their aims. So, if we want to increase demand, what do we have to do? We've got to do two things. One, we have to increase employment. And two, we have to put more money in that consumer's pocket. Because they're going to follow their hierarchy. What is that? Place to sleep. Food to eat. So now we're comfy and fed. But there's a natural progression of things that we spend money on. The last thing that we spend money on is frivolity. We only do that when we have excess dollars to actually spend. Otherwise, we don't do that. We do low-cost things. We go to a friend's house. We play cards. We watch a movie we haven't seen on TV. We do a lot of things, but we don't go out and spend. We do go out and spend when we have dollars in our pocket that, after all of our hierarchical needs are taken care of, that we have money left. That's not happening. Now, just look at the numbers. Consumer spending was down 0.5 point. Productivity went down 1.2%. GDP is maybe only up 1.2%, and I would be willing to bet that that's comprised of two things. One, defense spending, and two, unemployment. And that is being spent on necessities, not things that you want simply because you want them. Now, I don't know about anybody else, but when times get tough, our budget gets a major revision. And we look at every dollar we spend and say, do we need to put it there? Can we get by with less? Now, in my case, I'm retired, fixed income, which means that the bulk of my money goes for insurance, house insurance, car insurance, medical insurance. That's where most of it goes. Those people who are still working, and by the way, count yourself very lucky if you're still working, you have different options. You can. Now, obviously, I cannot cut down any further on my car insurance. I suppose I could, but it's going to be pretty minimal. Not going to cut down on my house insurance. Probably couldn't if I wanted to. I don't know. I could maybe cut down on my food. I'd have to shop smarter. I could give up drinking. But there's a limited panoply of things that I can do to reduce my expenditures. Increasing my income is not a big option. Mainly my increases in income depends on if there are fires and does my lady go out on. Other than that, we've got what we got. Those people who are working have different options. They may not be palatable options. They may not be options that you can exercise right this instant, because I don't know anybody raising wages other than the federal government and unions. So you also have to look at your budgets. You may have a little bit more leeway, and that's good. I don't envy you that. I mean, that's great. It's perfectly fine. But you still need to be smart. You still need to spend that wisely, and you need to save. And incidentally, the savings rate is up. Last number I saw was like 5.9%. That's a huge increase. The problem with that is this. They count paying off debt as savings. Now, I'm kind of old-fashioned. Savings to me means you put it in the bank, you've got access to it later. To them, it means, not so much. If you pay down your debt, that counts as savings. So, other than that minor quibble, I think that, you got to pay down debt. I mean, that's prudent in this particular day and age. But I think you need to put money away, actual money that you've earned, that you can get at later. More virtuous incentives. Why don't we cut taxes? Now, Liberals would have you believe, oh no, we can't cut the government's revenue. But JFK and Ronald Reagan, most famously, proved that canard wrong. You, in fact, can cut tax rates and receive increases in revenue. Government doesn't want to admit that. I understand why they don't, but they want to admit that. The reverse, though, of that sentiment says, as an ultimate thing, the government owns 100% of what you make. Now, first off, I deny the premise. The government owns zero of what I make. They can require that I pay some portion of it in taxes, but only to the point that it actually provides a good and benefit to me. Not to society in general, but to me. And by me, I mean people. For instance, the environmental laws were passed to provide a society-wide good. We weren't apparently taking care of our environment, and so they had to pass a law. And those started out actually pretty small. First thing I remember about it was back in about 1958, and the county of Los Angeles, wherein I resided, outlawed backyard incinerators. Had a terrible smog problem, and it was obviously the incinerator's fault. And so therefore, we can take care of that. We simply ban them. Fast forward a couple of years, and it's, oh my God, we're running out of landfill space. Gosh, unintended consequence there, huh? I can't burn it up anymore, so I have to put it in the trash, and now you don't have any damn place to dump it, fool. Now, that was before cogen, or at least before that became a buzzword. But it seems to me that if it was burnable trash, that they could collect it, burn it, and sell the power. I'm just silly me, but it seems to me like you could do that. But what do I know? I'm just a country banker. Don't have a lot of expertise in that kind of stuff. But that's the kind of thing that we need. We need to look critically at what our government does, what it says it's going to do, and the incentives it puts in place to do that. Environmental laws tick me off, not because I hate the environment. I don't. I love the environment. I live in a beautiful valley, got a bald eagle nest just across the river from me that I watch. By the way, they've raised 3 chicks in 2 years. That's a good thing. But you know what? Those same environmental laws that theoretically brought back those eagles also shut off farming. Actually, they shut off the water, which shut off farming. And 400,000 people are no longer working. Now, that's a lot of people. I mean, there are towns in that area here in California where the unemployment rate is 60% and 70%. That's dumb. And that's all for a two-inch bait fish. There's got to be some rhyme or reason to it. It cannot simply be, oh gosh, we have to save that poor, warm, fuzzy, slimy, wet creature, whatever it is. I mean, the other famous case is the dam back in, where was it, Tennessee, someplace like that, found a damn snail larder, and they shut the damn thing down. That isn't what those laws were designed to do. That isn't what we set out to do. But the thing grew like topsy-turvy. And now you have, actually have had, for quite a while, where anybody can sue to enforce environmental law. It used to be it was only the federal government or the state government, if they had environmental laws, they could sue. Whoever it was that thought up the idea that anybody could sue was a damn idiot. Because not only could they sue, but they could get their attorney's fees. I mean, this is really a loser pays kind of a situation here, folks. If they win their lawsuit, they get their attorney's fees. Those are always padded, by the way, because they got to put overhead in on them. And so what happens? They get more money to file more lawsuits. What do you think they're going to do? They're going to file more lawsuits. Doesn't matter, because they win often enough that it's a great game for them. And they can get us, you and me, to fund it for them. I mean, yeah, I suppose some of it comes out of their pocket, too, in taxes and that kind of stuff. But nevertheless, the vast majority of us pay for that. And that, I'm sorry, that's simply wrong. If the Fed wants to sue over a snail darter, let them sue. If the state wants to sue over a 2-inch bait fish, fine, let them sue. But it really ought not to be any Tom, Dick, and Harry that comes along that says, oh, I want to represent everybody and sue. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense at all. And frankly, it pisses me off. So, okay, more virtuous incentives. Right now, the tax rates are scheduled to go up January 1, 2011. And the lib logic is this. Well, it's not really a tax increase because we're only going to put them back to what they were when Clinton was in office. That's not really a tax increase. My logic says I had $100, you were taking out 20 of it, and now you're going to take out 30. I'm sorry, that's a tax increase. I don't care how you cut it. I don't care how you want to spin it or anything else. That's a tax increase. The last argument that I heard was, well, you know, there had to have been a reason why they passed that so that they would extend now. Had to be a reason for that. Well, you know what? And further that logic goes, and the reason for that was this was an experiment so that we could see how it worked, so that we could then decide whether we needed to keep it going or not. No, no. Here's the real reason. The Republicans didn't have 60 votes in the Senate, and so they had to compromise. When was the last time, by the way, you heard a Democrat compromising? No, you didn't. Okay. Crickets. All right. Anyway, so they didn't have 60 votes in the Senate, and they needed to score it under the CBO thing. Now, I don't know why that doesn't qualify as an emergency, but it apparently doesn't. I don't know why that doesn't qualify as strictly a fiscal thing, which only requires a 51-vote majority, but it doesn't. And so they couldn't get 60 votes, and so they had to compromise. The compromise that they worked out with the opposition was that those tax increases would all sunset December 31, 2010. And it looks like they're going to. Unless the Dems bring it back up in a lame duck session. Now, they can do that. Actually, probably not a lame duck session. They could maybe do that before November the 2nd. I don't think that they're going to, but I think that they could try. I think their tactic is going to be, well, we know you all don't want a lame duck session because Congress just changed hands, but we're still in power. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to extend that for all of these little people down here, but we're going to let everything else kick up. And by the way, we're going to add some more dollars to that to give to our union buddies. And you can vote for that, or you can vote against it, and we're going to hammer you people about tax breaks for the wealthy. Now, if anybody has looked at the numbers, those were not tax breaks for the wealthy. The biggest share of those dollars went to low-income workers. More people fell absolutely off the tax rolls. Did the rich people get some? Yeah, they did. So what? I mean, this isn't, you know, like we got to share the misery, is it? Shouldn't this ought to be, we're celebrating because we're sharing the wealth? Maybe not. I don't know. It just seems to me that we can no longer continue on the way we are. It seems to me we can no longer continue on the way of 47% of the American people don't pay any income tax whatsoever, and a very large portion of those that don't pay any income tax whatsoever get money back. Now, that's just plain wrong. I'm sorry, you got a lot of different ways to take care of people. You don't have to be giving them federal tax money. If you think people in your state are too poor, you are more than welcome in your state to improve their condition however you would like to. In California, that's pretty good. Other states might not be so good. But it doesn't mean that you're going to take federal tax receipts and you're going to divvy them out to, quote, the poor, end quote. That's not anything but tax and wealth redistribution. That's all it is. It has no rhyme or reason. Been a lot said about the fair tax. Let me tell you my problem with the fair tax. My problem with the fair tax is this. You purposefully collect more money than you need to run the government so that you can give it back to people. Folks, I don't care how you want to put that, that's wrong. Because the government is always going to retain some portion of that for their own use, over and above what it was we theoretically all agreed on they needed to use to operate. Doesn't make any sense at all. Flat tax I can handle. No deductions, no nothing. Here's a flat tax. Pay it. You're okay. I don't see either one of those gaining any traction. Well, no, I take that back. The fair tax could. The problem is the form it's going to take is a VAT tax, and that's going to be on top of your income tax. Because I think that's the only thing left that the government can do. Right now, the government today and the Federal Open Market Committee said, well, we shot our wad with interest rates. We effectively have them at zero. So now we're just going to buy Treasury debt. And all that means is, oh boy, we get to print money. And we just hope and pray that somebody buys it. Better hope and pray that that happens. China's hitting a rough patch. They've got a housing bubble going on, and that's going to break at some point in time in the future. I don't know when, but it's going to. You've got Europe in its moribund economy. You've got the Pergs. Poland, Italy, somebody, Ireland, whatever, Germany, Greece, not Germany. They are so close to sovereign debt default that they might as well. And we're rapidly getting there. So, I've been pessimistic tonight, and I'm sorry, it's true, I have been. I'm looking for a way out. I don't have a lot of confidence in this administration's ability to do anything. I think it's going to get worse in the time between now and the elections. I think it's going to get even worse after the elections until January the 20th. I guess the only thing that I can tell you is this. If you live in a city, you're vulnerable on a number of fronts. I'm sorry, but that's true. Keep a full tank of gas. Have a place in mind that you can go to that is outside of the city, preferably someplace in the country. Make sure that you have an ability to protect yourself. Make sure that you have at least enough food to feed yourself and anybody with you for 7 days. Have a go bag. Make sure you keep that stocked. And then cross your fingers. Now, very rarely do the most pessimistic conclusions come true. This doesn't usually happen that way. But you know what? You're no worse off for having been prepared, and you are infinitely better off if worst case does come to happen. People are angry. People aren't really willing to take it anymore. Everything has been fairly polite and civil so far. We will see what happens with the elections. And as long as those old things are all good, you're good to go. Keep a go bag handy, but you're still good to go. If things run amok, things don't turn out the way a majority of the people think they ought to have turned out, then that becomes an open question. So, you need to be prepared, just like a good Boy Scout. Incidentally, did anybody catch that news? The Boy Scouts booed President Obama. Now, I'm assuming that that was his video presentation to them on the occasion of their 100th anniversary. So far as I know, he has not addressed them directly, person to person. But I thought that that was pretty telling. Boy Scouts are generally respectful. They, in fact, practice their creed. And for them to express any kind of displeasure at an adult figure, an adult authority figure, to me, is kind of telling. It's disquieting. It's a little uncomfortable. But for me, it's telling. Because Boy Scouts just don't do that. That's not how they're brought up. That's not how they train. It isn't anything about them. And so I don't know what that portends. Folks, I got to go. So, I want to give a shout-out to Hallie 5, Mama Gurkha, Arkansas Traveler, Just Me Pammy, Hippie Chick, Tish, all of you folks. Thank you so much for listening. Hope I didn't bring you down too bad. Be prepared. That's all I can tell you. Everybody have a really good evening. Bye.